Supply chain attacks and other application exploits are growing faster than ever. A big reason is because vulnerable CI/CD systems, service accounts, and microservices don't have an identity. No identity means no authentication and authorization when these services are used to maximize the blast radius of an attack. That's why Teleport created Machine ID. Machine ID delivers identity-based access and audit for infrastructure resources like servers and databases, CI/CD automation, service accounts, and custom code in applications such as microservices. By consolidating identity-based credentials for engineers and the application they write, Teleport closes the identity loophole that enables compromised infrastructure and code to be used in cyber attacks. Visit us at goteleport.com. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cloud Native Month on Cloud Security Podcast. We are talking about how to become a cloud native security engineer. Yes, this is actually a field now. There are enough applications that are running in production on cloud native technologies like Kubernetes, Service Mesh, and others. So it was bound to happen, and it is happening. So for this, we had Pushkar Joglekar, who works for VMware Tanzu as their senior cloud security engineer, and his role is basically working on cloud native technology day in, day out, open source basically, and how to secure them. So I had to bring him in, and we spoke a lot about the space, how it has kind of moved and changed a lot in the years that have taken to mature Kubernetes and a lot more projects that have come in. What does a native architecture look like in terms of when you build an application? What are some of the components that you're thinking of securing? How do you even do threat modeling for something like a cloud native application? All that and a lot more in this amazing episode of Cloud Native Security. This is probably world first in a lot of ways. I don't think I have ever come across a cloud native security engineer role, at least personally, not that I'm hiring for that kind of role at this point in time, but it is definitely something that we are finding that is happening more and more in terms of conversation. So hopefully you find this helpful, or someone you know who's probably looking to get into cloud native, they might find this episode helpful. Feel free to share with them. And if you are there sharing this episode, please, if you get an opportunity, do leave us a review or a rating on iTunes and Spotify. It definitely helps us spread the word. And thanks to that, we are able to help a lot more people. So thank you so much for spreading the word and sharing with other people who we can help out as well. And another exciting thing to talk about with you folks is that Cloud Security Podcast is going on the road. And the first city that we're going to is going to be, it's going to be London. Yes, we are in London from this weekend onwards. And we would love to hang out with you if you are in London and would love to talk about cloud security, or in general, have a good coffee and recommend a few places. Feel free to reach us out on the email address that is on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv. If you find it would be valuable for us to hang out in your office or with your colleagues, feel free to reach out for that as well. We are looking to do a few events, say hello to as many of you as you can. So really excited about this, that we are able to finally start traveling again, and why not travel with the podcast? So I look forward to seeing those people who would be attending the events that we are co-hosting or speaking at. Do recommend a city that you would love for us to attend. At the moment, we have London, Boston, and San Francisco planned out till the end of July. We still have the entire year after that as well. So if you have a city in mind where we should come on to, definitely reach out and let us know which city you would want us to come to, and we will make it happen as well. So I will see you on the next episode if I don't see you in person. All right, talk to you in the next episode. Stay safe. Peace.
Hey, everyone. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad you came in, man. I think we definitely need to talk more about this field that's coming up in around us. We just haven't really brought it into light yet. So I'm glad we could bring the light in. So before we get into it, we've got a few more people coming in. Could you share a bit about, for people who may not know who you are, because you've been in my vicinity for a while, in the CNCF circle for some time as well. Could you share a bit about your professional journey into the whole cloud native security space?
Yeah, so I'm a senior security engineer at VMware Tanzu, but I am also very active in open source community, especially in the last couple of years. So I started in Kubernetes cloud native world about 6-7 years ago, where Docker was getting a lot of visibility and a lot of adoption. So I started working on that from an end user perspective in like a very large end user company. And then I was the new person in the security team of people who have been veterans in the security domain for many, many years. And Docker was something new. I was new. So they were like, hey, let's give this to the new person. So they basically asked me like, can you figure out how people are using Docker? And that's how I really started work there for several years, got really deep into it over multiple years. Then Docker led to Kubernetes, then led to working and getting part of community. And it was really about, instead of making cloud native secure for one company, why not make it for everyone? So that's why I switched to VMware, which allows me to do open source work as part of my day job. And so far it's been great. 1 year, 1 month.
That's pretty awesome. So you get to work on open source tool. Because that's probably a good segue into, like, because you mentioned open source as well. Cloud native is primarily open source tools as well. It's nothing else but open source tools. So it's pretty awesome you get to pay to work on open source tools. So what is cloud native, so that people can get that primer and everyone's in the same level field? And when you say cloud native security, what do you really mean?
Yeah, exactly. So it's basically about, if I have an application, I want to run it. You could run it on a phone. You could run it on a laptop. You could run it on your refrigerator. But if there is an application that you run on a cloud, there are some things that are common across clouds, whether you're running it on public cloud or private cloud. So in those cases, the way you build that application, the way you deploy, the way you continue to upgrade and update it has some specific patterns and design that get applied. And those together make an application cloud native and make a platform where you can run multiple apps cloud native. Securing that application, that platform on any of the clouds is really what cloud native security is.
Oh, right. And so what are some of the examples of cloud native projects that people would have heard of, which is just around them, but they don't realize they're cloud native? And obviously there are a lot of projects I can imagine, but I'm sure there's a lot of common ones as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, few things come to mind clearly is like the thing that made it really popular. The whole concept of cloud native is Docker over a period of several years, almost a decade in next year, maybe. And then that led to the more popular orchestrators like Kubernetes, which was the first, in a way, like really well adopted, widely adopted orchestrator for cloud native apps. Then we had some different apps who thought about solving common problems in all the clouds by writing it in such a way that they're cloud native. So things like HashiCorp Vault, Consul adopted the microservices architecture and design and led the way in terms of development of cloud native. And then now we have several more things like different runtimes like Containerd. Then we have multiple tools that do service mesh. And then there are eBPF tools like Cilium. So it's really been growing and growing and growing. And yeah, just really started with one or two tools that caught attention.
Right. So technically, when people talk about Kubernetes, they're talking about one of the projects of cloud native, right? They're not talking about, because I mean, Kubernetes by itself is just not, that's not the entirety of cloud native.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's easy to imagine that because it really started with Kubernetes. So, and Kubernetes continues to be kind of the foundation around and on top of which multiple other tools are being developed. But then there are so many other things that you need to run your app in Kubernetes securely. And even Kubernetes is not one thing. It has like four or five different components. And all of that together really is going to make your whole environment cloud native.
Yeah, because it's hard to imagine a place where it got so popular that there are definitely roles that are coming up to specialize in that. And I think there's a lot of companies around the world that have adopted quite widely. They're putting them into production as well. And is that kind of one of the reasons why there are specific roles for this? Like there's enough, I mean, there are a lot of open source projects in the world, right? This is clearly not the only one. So what do you think gave it that drive? Why did people adopt this over all the other open source projects?
Yeah, I think the first thing I note, if I understand your question correctly, was why do people care about securing something that is cloud native? And why is it really caught attention of everyone where there are now dedicated roles for that? So for me, it really feels culmination of multiple things. So 5-6 years ago, I think there was maybe not 5-6 or around that time, probably there was a first role that was published by some company which said, we want people who know Kubernetes. And that kind of created a really like a cascading effect of multiple roles asking for Kubernetes. And so there is a different, people are coming at from different angles. I think one angle is like, you are going in terms of this new shiny thing that's going to solve my problem. And some people are coming into this world saying, oh, what is the business value of adopting this? And as the adoption increased and important business critical applications started getting built and deployed on top of Kubernetes, suddenly securing that whole box became really important. Yeah. And then everyone was like, okay, we need to know people or and have people in our team who can tell us how to secure it, because it feels like maybe some tool will help me, but I don't know how do I apply this tool for my environment. I don't know whether it will cover all the threats I care about. I don't know when I'm migrating from a centralized monolithic architecture to microservices architecture, how my security is going to look different. So all of those things came together, and now people like me kind of just focus on that and really have fun doing it.
That's pretty awesome. I think it's pretty cool that you get to work in a new space. I think working in open source was always used to be something that people do that in their volunteering time. Like they do their 9-to-5 job, and that's basically what you said. It's true business value because you're working on proprietary software and yeah. Office and all that. Like basically, but the whole open source world has definitely opened the eyes. Actually, there's more to this. Like we should actually be contributing into how we can make this better. Okay, coming back to this, Kubernetes got really popular. There was a lot of adoption. High value business assets kind of started being built on Kubernetes. At that point in time, obviously people started asking for Kubernetes. So what does every day look like for people working in this space? I mean, like it's such a new thing. I'm wondering what's a day look like in your life, I guess.
Yeah, so I think for me, I was sort of surprised how foundations of security really helped me getting more familiar and better at what I do, even without thinking about what cloud native would mean in terms of security. So the people I worked with in the past really helped me get those basics right. And they used to give me time to learn basic things like how TLS works and how certificates works, how CA works. And then all of those things, especially in case of Kubernetes, which is really big on certificate authorities, it all came together and helped me. So for me, that is something I try to do. Like I have to learn something every day, or at least a day in my week, try to focus mostly on learning. And then apart from that, there are so many things like vulnerability management. How am I managing my secrets? And then what are the problems that everybody is trying to solve? What are the new tools that are helping solve problems that are more relevant now versus maybe 2-3 years ago? So typically I would look at day job things like, okay, what VTs do I need to care about? How do I assess whether this one really matters to me? How do I make sure that I can accept that fix? And then this is all useful and possible when I'm able to threat model my entire, where I'm able to figure out, okay, in my cloud native environment, what are the threats I care about? What are my weak spots and data flows, which are really important for me? So I take a look at that, figure out what to do. And then 50% of my time goes there. Rest of it is really like, how can we make Kubernetes more secure? How can we make all the other things around Kubernetes more secure? So I end up working in different communities at CNCF and Kubernetes level, get to work with people all around the world having same goals like me, and just trying incrementally to make everything more secure than it was yesterday.
All right. And that's probably a good segue into a question that came from Chris Watkins has a question. What are all the parts of a cloud native architecture? It's kind of like was going to be my next question. What does an application look like in this kind of...
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think probably I am going to 100% miss some things, but I'll try my best in terms of like kind of explain it through a story. So yeah. I have an application. I want to run it in a cloud native way, right? What I would do is figure out, okay, what image, container image, I want to package it in. So I would create a Docker file and write everything that I need in that Docker file, and then build that container image that's going to run my application. Now I have that image. If I send it to and say you run this command, it will run on their machine the same way on my side. So next thing is, now I want to run it in production. Everyone is happy with this app image. So I would push it into a container registry, which is basically like a library of container images where you can pull a book and put it back, or pull a book, take it home, and then bring it back in a few days. So similar to that, it's you push that image, it goes into that registry. And now whichever environment has access to that registry can take it basically by pulling that image into any cloud server. So if you work in any, and you go there and do Docker pull, it will pull it. So now the problem is like, I can't keep pulling my images wherever I want to run it. So I need something, make sure that my images and containers run in a way where I don't have to worry about if it goes down for some reason. So that's where orchestrators come in, where things like Kubernetes give you guarantees saying that okay, I will run your application in three different nodes, where one instance of your application each will run. And if one node goes down, I will make sure I'll find another node that will run the instance that has gone down. So with that guarantee, now I know my application is always going to be up. My application is up, but nobody can access it because it's running in a private network. So that's where load balancers come in and things like service mesh come in, where if you need to talk to each other. So once the application is accessible to everyone, then on client side, you start accessing it and creating business value.
Oh, right. Okay. So Kubernetes is basically helping you scale the architecture in a lot of ways, in a way that it's reliable and a way highly available.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, I know for sure if I tell Kubernetes something, unless Kubernetes cluster itself goes down, I know for sure it's going to do what I told it.
Okay, so just to extend that analogy then to, I guess, to Chris's point is, I guess, where the question is coming from. So from a security perspective, the fundamentals would not really change then. Like, so sounds like, apart from the addition of Kubernetes being the orchestrator, there are other parts, obviously, like what you mentioned with Docker container or like, you know, things that would be images. But from a security fundamental perspective, it should still be, I guess, it's still protecting the application. So you mentioned threat modeling earlier, threat modeling still applies. Once you have built this, I guess there's an architecture component as well, where you kind of think about identity, authentication, authorization, encryption, backup and restore, all that. So Cloud Native is just one component of all of that, or Cloud Native answers to most of them, and we just look after identity. And like, is there a separation like that as well in there?
Place where this sort of feels different compared to monolithic architecture and securing that is some things that we assumed were static or not change a lot in this architecture. So as an example, IP address in a monolithic static architecture, I always knew my node is going to have this IP address. So if this particular node or a server wants to talk to another node or server and there is a firewall in between, I could write a rule in the firewall saying these two servers are okay to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Now, because I'm running multiple applications on my and those applications get assigned IP addresses dynamically, my rule will not work if I just apply it based on the IP address I know at that time. So those things change. And also the separation of duties and separation of concerns apply a bit differently. So if I am a platform provider for Kubernetes, worry or concern is going to be how can I deploy Kubernetes cluster in the most secure way possible. But I will not care about whether your application is secure. And I will let you decide how you want to secure your application. And same thing, but in the opposite sense is if I am an application owner, I'm going to make sure my application is most secure. And I'm going to assume and hope that you as a provider are doing a good job of securing the cluster I'm running my application on.
Interesting. So because the funny thing is, one of the things that I thought of when I read Chris's question was, I always imagine we have so many projects in Cloud Native, man. It's like we had a topic on, William Morgan came in last week and he spoke about service mesh. And then there is Kubernetes. And I'm sure there's like, so EBPF is like, then there is the OPA. Like there's so many projects in there. Like how does this all, because I imagine when you would answer a question about Cloud Native architecture, in my head, I'm going, you'll talk about service mesh. This is how it talks to OPA, then there's a Kubernetes. And so is that not how these applications are built? Like, is that just like, maybe I'm misinformed?
Yeah, so all of these tools are helping solve a problem, basically. Okay. So if we take a look at service mesh, I now have, instead of 10 monolithic apps, I now have 100 apps. All of them want to talk to each other and they are all running in different languages. I don't know how I'm going to make sure they're always mutual TLS enabled and they're always communicating through encryption channels on TLS. So what service mesh really allowed us to do is run a sidecar along with your application and we will take care of that problem for you.
But that would be inside your pod?
Yes.
Oh, so you still need Kubernetes as a platform layer. And on top of that, you will have service mesh, which would do that mutual TLS part. And then there would be OPA to do the authorization policies as well.
Yeah, so the OPA could work with or without service mesh, where now I want to figure out, even for securing Kubernetes, sometimes I want to make sure I want to allow some pods, I don't want to allow some pods. So in that case, you can also use OPA, saying if you're running an application that wants to run as privileged pod, I'm going to disallow it as a platform provider. And to your point, in a service mesh, people could decide to use OPA in perspective for authorization, where service A can talk to service B, but I don't want it to talk to service C. So I'll define that policy in one place. And then the good part about these architectures is once I define that policy, I can apply it across multiple clusters. So I have to define it once, and then it can be applied across multiple clusters. So it makes it easier for us to define what we want. And to the point about IP addresses, the identities now is not static. So my IP address is always going to be different. So now I have to define my own workload identity using things like Spiffy or Spire, for example. And then they allow me to help identify myself and authenticate myself. By myself, I'm saying I'm an application. So if I'm an application, I will say, hey, this is my identity, this is the proof of it. And now you, if you accept this proof, you should allow me to do whatever somebody has defined for this application to be allowed to be done in this cluster.
Right. I think I'm pretty sure people are going to rewind and go back to this particular part of the interview again and again, because this is the most confusing part about the whole cloud native space, where you almost always hear, because if you look at the landscape project thing that CNCF has, there's like at least 50 applications in there. And you're going, do I have to use all of that? Or, by the way, hopefully that answers your question, Chris. Thanks for that. I look at that and go, do I have to use all of them to have a cloud native run application? But what I'm hearing from you is actually you don't need all of it. You just need certain components of it. And to what you even said in the beginning of the interview, if it solves a business value, maybe that's when it would make the most. Would that be right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, at least my perspective always is, if something is going to solve a problem, I will use it. Otherwise, I don't need it. And there could be situations where I don't know a problem exists. Mm-hmm. And then I will just give myself grace to accept that fact that I made a mistake and then use that tool later when
Right. So maybe, and now if I ask you the same question again with the whole, what are some of the main components when people think about application, which is a cloud native application, like fresh off, I mean, it's basically you and I just came up with the next Facebook.com idea, and we're going to build that today. And we want to build that in Kubernetes. Actually, why would I even do that? Like, out of curiosity, what makes people go for cloud native tools to build? Because it's not that you can't scale. I mean, we've been scaling for a long time, right? I mean, it's not like Kubernetes is this, I don't know, Einstein equals MC square kind of formula, or is it that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I mean, so it really is something potentially contrasting in terms of whoever you ask, people will have different answers for it. My perspective is that if I don't have access to a cloud, I could not even see in real life how something scales. But if I have Kubernetes running in, let's say, my Docker desktop on my laptop, I can run multiple node cluster there and see things actually work and scale as I want. So it really, sometimes the word is misused, but it really democratized the scaling and the performance of how you can deploy something and it will automatically scale regardless of which cloud you're using. That's, I think, in my opinion, the best reason to use Kubernetes, where if you don't know where you are going to end up deploying your cluster or deploying your application, starting with Kubernetes will help you deploy it anywhere where a cloud supports Kubernetes cluster.
Okay, so I get this now. So it's basically, I mean, would it be cloud agnostic then? Okay, so that kind of sounds like a great point. So I should technically be able to build my entire application as a whole. And for some reason, I started in AWS, but I started to hate it. And I'm just going to go to the next guy. And I go to Azure, or I go to GCP or IBM or Oracle Cloud, and I'm still able to do the application exactly the way I built it on the first part and move it to the next.
Right, exactly. It's all, I think, software throughout multiple years, even before I was born, has been about creating abstractions that are easier to build on top of. So these days, like, we don't even think a lot about kernel code or compilers a lot, most of the software engineers. So similarly, like, if I don't have to worry about what cloud I am using and how do I scale it on this particular cloud, then it just makes it easier and creates business value, where I don't have to figure out and teach multiple engineers how to do something. And then it is easier to explain the business value out of it.
So coming back to the question, so I understand how different a cloud native application would be. I kind of also understand that all these different components of service mesh and everything else is going to open and everything else is going to go in. So if I were to kind of draw a line on the sand with, okay, if I want cloud agnostic and I probably need scale orchestration in a way that I'm able to do a lot more things in a scalable way, I go for cloud native. So at what point would I go for something like an Amazon EKS or Azure Kubernetes service as well? So what role do those guys play in this?
Right. So remember earlier in the discussion, we said the separation of concerns problem is different here, where I as a cluster want to worry about securing my cluster. I will assume you are doing a good job of securing your application, and then vice versa for somebody who's an application owner. So if you're using something which is running Kubernetes in the cloud and you're just going to get a URL and endpoint where you point your kubectl, then I'm assuming that cloud provider who is providing me a Kubernetes cluster is going to secure that cluster.
Right. So if
I don't want to run my own cluster, then there could be good reasons for it. Then I would use something that is managed by somebody else, where my only responsibility is my application and my pod. And then as long as I see, I can use it. And then if I need to build things so like service or apply things like service mesh or network policies on top of it, I can do it as long as the cloud supports it and the cluster underlying supports it.
Interesting. Okay. So that brings me to the next question then, I guess. So if we are able to do that, and I guess Amazon takes care of everything or Azure takes care of everything, the only draw to say being purely cloud native, and when I say pure cloud native, I mean you build in cloud in Kubernetes containers and you're just packaging it and moving it between different applications. And you would probably only do that if you don't want to be responsible for the platform. So I imagine the whole security responsibility kind of transfers over to Amazon or Azure as well. If you go for services, like at that point, we would be able to say if we are using a traditional one, you kind of still have to think about backup, disaster recovery, all that stuff would still be your responsibility. But if you use the Amazon or Azure or Google Cloud version, they take care of all of that. Even the Google Cloud version, which is, I guess, it's their project, right? That started off
Kubernetes. So Kubernetes did start in Google, but then now it's more like a neutral project managed by a separate foundation, probably worth exploring that more. But to your point, the ideas of backup and recovery and making sure that I'm not losing my data, or if a node goes down, I'm sure the new node is going to take its place. Those things get taken care by the cloud. But in simple terms, with very minor changes, my deployment YAML, which is my definition of how my application should run in Kubernetes, is not going to change a lot, regardless of which Kubernetes provider I'm going to deploy my application in. So I think that's the biggest benefit you get by having that abstraction layer instead of running just on any cloud. And then you sort of have to stick with how they define their application.
Right. I sometimes describe this thing as, so the people, you know, how talk about Apple, iPhone and Android. I sometimes explain this like that. If you want to be in control of your OS and I don't know, just like have it pulled apart and everything, you probably would go down the path of, I'm going to use Kubernetes to build all this and do it from scratch. But you don't really care about the OS. You just want to use your phone and you just want Android or OS. It doesn't really matter whichever one you go for. Then you go for these Amazon, Azure and Google Cloud kind of services. Would that be a good analogy to kind of put this across for people who may not have?
It's very similar. Another analogy I've heard recently is buying your own house and renting an apartment in a big building where don't have to worry about plumbing, gutters, electricity, gas, anything like that. And but in case of if you're owning your house, you have to take care of these. But then the benefit is you get to play around with the land you have and you can do whatever you want there. But in case of an apartment, you're kind of limited with in scope in terms of what you can do, but you get multiple different advantages.
Fair point. Cool. I've got another question from Rama here. From architecture point of view, where do we start? Is it from standpoint, then other layers like service mesh, OPA, etc., or should we step up, start from a bigger picture and drive deeper into each layer? It feels like a chicken and egg situation to me.
Yeah, it's tough. Like I'm assuming this is more from security architecture point of view.
Yes.
So what I would say is like, forget all the tech stack and tools and everything. We should ask ourselves and the team we are working with, what do we care and what are we worried about going wrong for my application? So if let's say I am social media website, like you were suggesting earlier, I care about availability. I want to make sure it's always up. I want to make sure like the login and password credentials are secure when user is trying to log in. So I want to make sure like I want to do mutual TLS and I want to make sure it is never unencrypted in my cloud. So then I would want service mesh. So that's one example. And then things like if because I want something always available. I would want things like Kubernetes, because then I will have some guarantees of it running, always being up based on what I have defined. And from security perspective, you would want to figure out in this case whether my data is secure, and in those cases then you would also want to make sure you have disaster and backup recovery. So for those, then you will use cloud native tools that provide that. So like I said earlier, instead of, because the tech stack is so huge and the landscape is so vast, it's so overwhelming and confusing, so just focusing on what I care about, what my team cares about, what are we worried about, will automatically lead us to a tool that might solve that problem.
Right. So instead of taking a technical approach, just go back to the fundamentals of security and take it from there. I think that's probably recommending.
Yeah. And if you have to go like one level deeper here, I would define what I care about, what I worry about into different categories of threats. So I use my threat modeling mechanism called STRIDE, which is spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege. So I try to categorize what I care about, what I worry about into those six, and then figure out, okay, these things matter to me, and then which category I really care about among all of them, and focus on that, and then go from there. I also wrote a perspective of how to secure Kubernetes with those categories in mind in one of the books with Nigel as well.
Oh yeah, I'll definitely give a shout out to the book as well. Nigel Poulton, right? Yeah, so that entire thing, the STRIDE structure of doing threat modeling, that totally works in this context. What are some of the examples of each one of these components, out of curiosity, if I may be putting you on the spot? Are there any examples that you can think of for each one of those STRIDE?
Yeah, so let's take, like, if I'm threat modeling using STRIDE for Kubernetes and we pick spoofing, I would want to make sure that if I'm using kubectl to access my cluster, I know the person who is saying they are accessing the cluster is the same person actually accessing the cluster. So for those things, I would ensure that I have a mutual TLS, so where API server can authenticate itself and me as a user can authenticate myself using some level of authentication. And then you can have plugins like LDAP provider, where you can say, I will use my LDAP credentials to authenticate myself to API server. And then API server contacts with your LDAP directory and says, hey, somebody is saying they are this, can you verify? And then it verifies and gives you a response back. So that would be spoofing. And then we can go on like for other five as well, if we have time.
I think so. The only one that I can think of, which I'm curious about, is the integrity is just encryption, I imagine.
Yeah, you mean tampering or information disclosure?
Well, yeah, sorry, maybe actually a good point would be if you have one example for each one of them, if you don't mind, because it's so interesting looking at a cloud native application, and I don't know how many people have done threat modeling for it, so I'm just curious. So we give the examples as well, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, go for it. Let's do that. So tampering, and this really applies not only for Kubernetes, any application that you're running on top of Kubernetes, but I'm just using Kubernetes itself as an example of how to apply it. So in case of tampering, it would be, I have my data store in Kubernetes where I'm storing everything in etcd. I want to make sure anything I'm storing, including configuration, my deployment configuration, my secrets, my network policies, are not tampered in etcd. So how do I prevent that? So one thing is, as an application owner running something on a Kubernetes cluster, I never need access to my, so restricting that access would be a good idea. And then having, again, mutual TLS between etcd and APS would be a good idea, where nobody else randomly can access etcd and start tampering with data. Yep. Then we have repudiation, where if I'm running something in Kubernetes and I'm doing some activity as a platform provider or cluster owner, I want to make sure I have audit logs of every action done on my cluster, so that if something went, I can figure out which event caused it and who triggered that event. So we have Kubernetes audit logs that give answers to what, where, when, and then based on that, you can figure out the answers to how and why. So having those audit logs enabled with appropriate rules would be a good idea to prevent non-repudiation.
Yep.
Then we have information disclosure, where again, I am storing, let's say, all my secrets in Kubernetes. By default, Kubernetes secrets are not encrypted. So that means that is going to be a bad idea if we keep it that way. So then applying things like encryption config, deciding to use KMS to encrypt secrets in etcd, or using a completely different secret provider and using that to store your secrets instead of storing it in Kubernetes. That could be one example. Then we have two more left. So denial of service. So denial of service could be, now I have my pods and accidentally I have injected a fork bomb in my application. So what fork bomb basically does is it will start eating up your resources on a node. And if it keeps going, it will exponentially keep eating up your resources on a node. And then eventually your node will run out of resources and it will start affecting other pods. So for those things, we can do things like applying requests and limits for pod, where we are able to say, okay, this is the max limit. After that, we are going to kill your pod. And then in the new one, will spin up. And then once this happens multiple times, then the cluster provider can say, hey, your pod is being killed multiple times. Something is wrong. And then last one, elevation of privilege is something like, I am an application owner. I don't want access as a owner of my cluster where I'm cluster admin. So for those having RBAC policy that link to your LDAP groups, and then you're able to give restrictive access to your cluster so that multiple different teams can share a cluster and still be able to see a specific point of view in your cluster instead of seeing everything on a cluster.
Awesome. By the way, thank you for doing that, because I think I am pretty sure I'm going to cut a snippet of that Stride example. It would definitely be something that people would go back to quite often. I think there's a comment from Vinit as well saying, we need to bring Pushkar again. So much to learn from him. So that people are definitely getting value from this man. To your point, we've applied the threat model. We've done Stride, and now we even have examples of what could be a Stride component that could go into this as well. Is there, sounds like, I mean, because the way you explain it, you sound, make it sound so easy as well. I'm assuming there's some challenges people come across in this space. Like, what do you hear people struggle with the most in this space, in the whole cloud native security space?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is jumping into securing something without spending enough time to understand it. So in one of my talks last year, maybe a couple of years back, actually, I said that you can't secure something if you don't understand. So I still believe that. And I was lucky enough to be given time to understand and learn something that was new. I was literally asked, until you can explain it to me so that I understand it, who has never read anything about it, spend as much time as you want. So that really helped me. So once I understood what Docker is, what Kubernetes is, pod is, what are the different components in Kubernetes, then after that, I was able to poke holes into it, where I was able to see, oh, what if this happens? Oh, what if that happens? If this happens, do I care about it? And that's where then slowly I started figuring out, okay, this is where my threat model is going to look like. So I really spent a lot of time reading, talking to people who know more than me, just asking questions and trying to understand it, taking notes, and then trying to figure out how to secure it. I think if that's the common thing I've noticed, like people jump way too ahead, and it's sort of similar to doing advanced calculus when we are just learning algebra. So remembering to do that and just being patient with yourself, like, okay, I don't know everything, so I have to start from somewhere. So let me start from understanding what I'm trying to secure.
Yep, that's a good point. And I think probably that's a good segue into the question that Vinit had much earlier. What do you recommend as a cloud native security pathway for beginners? Because it sounds like there's a, to hear what he was saying as well, without nose diving into something that you don't understand, what do you recommend for people who may be listening to this and going, oh man, I'm so inspired. I want to be working on open source. I want to do Kubernetes, become like a cloud native security engineer. What do you recommend as a path?
Yeah. So there are really multiple paths. It depends on what you like to do yourself. So if you are more like a hands-on learner where I just want to dive deep and run something in Kubernetes, then there are multiple YouTube videos, blog posts, documents in Kubernetes website itself, which allow you to do something very quickly. Minimal requirements, like just having Docker running on your laptop, is most of the times good enough. And then if, okay, I like to watch videos more and learn from it versus reading books and reading stuff, then you can focus on that. Because the good thing of being involved in a vibrant community like this one is there is so much to learn and so many resource materials in different formats, including things like this podcast, where you just can listen things and probably learn a bit. So figuring that out is important. And if you, and then also at the same time, if you feel like, oh, I don't know anything, I should just keep learning for like 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, that's also a bad idea, because then you sort of create your own bubble and don't figure out what really matters. And sometimes you go too deep into something or remain too shallow at some level. So once you feel like, okay, I'm getting a gist of it, maybe I know 50%, 60% of what I wanted, just dive into some open source communities. Cloud Native Computing Foundation has a Slack that's open for everyone. Kubernetes community has a Slack open for everyone. And then just try to see different channels that interest you and then watch different KubeCon videos from past events. All of them are in YouTube. Everything, all of them are free. There is no paywall or anything like that. So you can search anything you want, pick a talk from there, read it or watch it and read anything that they have linked. And then slowly and surely, you'll start to get hang of it. And once you start getting hang of it, that's the right time to ask, do I want to keep going? Or do I want to do something else? And once your answer, then you can keep going or you can skip this because this is not the only great thing happening in the world and you might find something that you might be more successful in.
Yeah, that's great advice as well, by the way. I was going to say, because there are so many projects in CNCF as well, are folks better off starting off with Kubernetes as because that sounds to be the foundational layer to a lot of cloud native. Are they better off starting there as a project, or is that too big a project to start with, or should they go for something else?
Yeah, I think in my personal opinion, it's hard to start on a project that's cloud native if we don't have a basic understanding of Kubernetes. It doesn't have to be at a level where you can write a 100-page book about Kubernetes. But if you can sum it up in a diagram and a one-pager, I think that's good enough information to know first. And then you can pick a project based on whatever your incentives are to start working on it.
Awesome. All right. Now, thanks for that. And I think you've answered Vinny's question as well. So thank you for that as well. Actually, that makes me think, just to Sama's question, where his last question is about, become a good engineer, good cloud engineer without having experience in programming before. So maybe taking a step further, say if Osama wanted to be a cloud native security engineer, does he or she or whoever is looking at this question and going, oh yeah, I've got that question, do they need to have a programming knowledge? Like, do they need to know some programs?
This is one question that gets asked a lot in community as well. Yeah. And I have met people who cannot program, be very successful in cloud native space by just bringing their strengths. So some people are really good writing docs and reviewing docs, and they just ended up becoming part of different special interest groups in Kubernetes, which focus on docs, became really great at it. Then some people really are good with people and they are able to bring people together to solve problems and then make Kubernetes better and more secure. So people did that. And some people were like, I don't know programming, but I want to get into this space and I'm going to give myself time to learn programming and start.
Yeah.
There have been people like that as well. So it's really up to you. Like, try it out for a few months. See if you like it. See what interests you more, what makes you sort of excited, and keep doing it until you feel like, oh, I've done enough, and then do something.
Yeah, actually, that's pretty cool. And when you say programming, it's worthwhile calling out. You're not talking about Java, or you're talking more about scripting languages. Is that right? Or Kubernetes native command language, I guess.
Right. So large majority of cloud native apps are written in most of the people who use Kubernetes will end up using something called YAML, which is sort of a scripting language, which allows you to define how to run your application. So always have to be very good with data structures and algorithms to even contribute to Kubernetes. As long as you're either willing to learn or do something that you already are good at, which many programmers are not good at, then that is a very valid path to success.
Awesome. No, thank you. And hopefully that answers your question as well. Thanks for that question, by the way. Cloud Security Podcast is going to be in San Francisco in June, I think. So, but thank you so much for this, man. I really appreciate the time that you spent with us as well. I know we are on the hour as well. So where can people reach out to you? So if they wanted to kind of have follow-up questions and or know more about this.
Yeah, so I have my website, which I can maybe put in the comments. Okay,
well.
Sounds good. Yeah, so I have my website, firstnamej.github.io, where you can find all my social media handles. But I'm more active on Twitter than LinkedIn. So if you want to reach out, just tweet at me and I'll try my best to.
Awesome. And thank you so much for doing this for us as well. I hope it was a great session. So thank you. I can't wait to have you again. And I just mentioned it was a great session. Thank you again. And for everyone else, we'll probably see you next weekend for another episode of the Cloud Native Security, which is running Cloud Native Security Month as in support for KubeCon and Cloud Native Con, which is happening next month in May. It's happening in Spain, but you can definitely hang out there virtually. And yeah, I think I'll be in London next week. So the next week, live streams running from London. So let's see how that pans out. But I will keep you posted. I'll see you folks in from London next week. And hopefully we can have Pushkar as well next time, because definitely there are a lot more questions we need to get answered. So thanks so much for your time, everyone. And we'll see you in the next episode next weekend. And I will see I'll say hello from London next week. All right. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.